You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Since the fall of the Soviet Union, it's been argued in academic, political, and media circles that democracy and free market capitalism go hand in hand, and that political freedom leads to economic freedom, and vice versa. But judging from John Kampner's new book, Freedom for Sale, Why the World is Trading Democracy for Security, Mr. Kampner, the former editor of The New Statesman, is not convinced. In fact, he sees what's known as authoritarian capitalism as being on the rise. His book is published by Basic Books. I'm very pleased that it brings John Kampner to our show today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
You say the kind of authoritarian capitalism you find in many countries comes about as a pact between the government and the governed. So this is not something that people are objecting to? Are they actually asking for it?
What I'm seeking to do in this book is to answer a fairly straightforward question. It is, why is it that increasing numbers of people, irrespective of their cultures, their geography, history, their circumstances, nevertheless, why are they increasingly willing to trade certain freedoms in return for the prospect of either security or liberty? And time and again, this is happening. Now, this is happening voluntarily. This is not happening through the barrel of the gun. We know all the great tyrannical regimes out there: Burma, North Korea, Zimbabwe, some would say Iran, and variations on a theme, Central Asian states, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, all these sort of countries where people are just simply frightened. This is different. This is a voluntary trade-off. This is where the state gives you certain circumscribed freedoms in return for not causing trouble.
But also, there's a certain amount of fear there. I remember when some people were setting up alarm bells because of restrictions on our freedom with the Patriot Act and such. Letters to the newspapers would say, well, have you forgotten the 9/11 attacks? We have to trade this off. We have to. It's the reason that we take our shoes off in the airport and don't complain.
Absolutely. Now, when it comes to this country, and I look at eight countries as country studies, and the United States is my final chapter. The first four countries are authoritarian or semi-authoritarian, and the other four countries are democracies or notional democracies. And the security agenda is obviously the most prevalent one here. We had the Patriot Act, we had Pfizer Act, we had many other either pieces of legislation or changes brought in by the back door. And I was asked, actually this morning, I was doing a book event elsewhere, and somebody talking to me about, don't you understand the need for security? Do you not understand the trauma that afflicted this city and the country with 9/11? And my answer is, emphatically, I do understand. We in Britain have been living for quite a lot longer, never with the sheer scale or the theatricality of 9/11. The issue isn't, do you have measures that enshrine security? It is trying to unpick this idea that no citizen can expect the state, the government, to guarantee them 100% security. It is just not possible. When you step out of the studio here, something terrible could happen to you, and nobody will protect you. And it is where you draw the line, where you draw the balance. And if you trade incessantly on fear, then you will produce a very unbalanced society.
A few years ago, I saw a film about a woman who watched video monitors because there is extensive surveillance all throughout Britain. Are people concerned about being watched when they walk down the street?
We have one-fifth of the world's closed-circuit television on our small island. It is astonishing. The next time any listener goes to London, they will be filmed an average of 200 times as they go about their daily lives. Now, you could say, well, what's
that
the problem?
That would upset me.
That's fine. What's the problem? I'm not doing anything wrong. In which case, that's fine. But where the problem lies is that this isn't openly debated. It's not really thought through. If people are entirely relaxed with a continuous salami slicing, a continuous handing over of freedoms, that's fine, but it has to be analyzed and it has to be discussed in those terms.
Well, does it have another kind of effect? For example, once you start accepting those things, then does it have an impact on other institutions? What about the press?
The press is absolutely fascinating because it operates, it is facing the same universal problems around the world, namely the demise of word on paper. And so there's a lot of global financial difficulties afflicting it. But there's more going on. And it is not just the way the press operates. It's what we expect of the press. And this comes back to this phrase I use time and time again in the book about the requirement of people to cause trouble. Because if you do not cause trouble, and that could be liberally interpreted, whether that is demanding free expression, whether it is demanding freedom of association, whether it is demanding your right to be active in civil society in the public realm, if you don't do that, if you're satisfied with what I call the private freedoms, which are the freedom to make money, to spend your money, the freedom to travel, to have your own sexual life, to have to choose schools for your kids, to wear the clothes that you want, if you simply are satisfied with your atomized freedoms and you just want the state to leave you alone to conduct your life like that, then you will end up with a much weaker set of checks and balances on power. And that is what's already happening.
And you suggest that the middle class is largely the group that's been willing to make this trade-off. The middle class, which in the past was pretty much the force for evolved democracy. The French Revolution is based pretty much on complaints of the middle class.
Yeah, the crux of the issue when, with the collapse of communism in 1989, the established thinking, and it wasn't simply Reagan-Thatcher type of thinking, it permeated all the way through the mainstream political class, was that you give people political freedom and economic freedom will come with it, or you give them economic freedom and political freedom will come with it.
China would open up because it now was open to capitalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Eventually, all the restrictions, the repression would end.
The two were symbiotic. And underpinning that was this sense that if you give people greater choice about their material well-being, that they will then they will bank that, and then they will ask for more. They will ask for more say in the way their street is run, more say in the way their community is run. And eventually it will permeate, because if you take people out of poverty into comparative wealth, they will want more. I think the saddest conclusion of the last 20 years is actually the reverse is the case. The bigger the bourgeoisie, for want of a better term, the more there is an impulse actually to hunker down. It's simply to protect what you have and don't get involved in other stuff, because that will just simply cause you trouble.
My guest is John Kampfner. His book, Freedom for Sale, Why the World is Trading Democracy for Security, is published by Basic Books. Well, I remember at the time that the Soviet Union fell, Francis Fukuyama wrote about the end of history. And then years later, he came on the show and admitted that he changed his mind about the end of history. So have we been changing our, have people like a conservative like Francis Fukuyama been rethinking all of these assumptions you've been talking about?
Well, I talked to Frank Fukuyama and others in the course of researching the book, and it is endlessly fascinating. Just to recall, it wasn't what he was saying was a brilliant phrase, but it was pretty much the conventional wisdom of the time that the West had won. We had won. That was it.
And now democracy was going to be everywhere.
It was going to be everywhere, and it was going to be interpreted fairly narrowly. I lived in the former Soviet Union during the collapse of communism. I lived in East Berlin when Germany unified. And there was just an assumption. It wasn't even hubris. It was just there that you privatize all their industries, you simply you inject the dollar, and they will all just want it, and it will just naturally succeed. And what is so fascinating, particularly Russia is an example of a country that's not quite working out. But what is so interesting is how the rise of China is making us reassess just that link between economic freedom and political freedom.
On the other hand, can't we argue that although China hasn't become a democracy, Russia isn't really a pure democracy, there's more democracy than there was before?
Yes, we certainly can. That would be the right thing to say. That is why my book is seeking very clearly to say we're not talking about totalitarianism. Maoist China and Soviet communist USSR were simply totalitarian states. What you have now are far more shades of grey. And that is much more challenging for policymakers here and in Europe in how to address that. Because in China, for example, or in Russia, they have opened up, but predominantly in the realm of what I call the private freedoms. My Russian friends, who never could leave the country except if you were on a recognized trade union or public delegation trip or whatever it was, they now fly to New York, to Paris, wherever, every day of the week. They're out and about the whole time. They are enjoying the consumer lifestyle lives that we have, and yet they do not have, to any significant degree, the public freedoms that we espouse, and they are quite happy for the moment with that trade-off. They're quite happy with the private freedoms.
As we saw in Russia, where the recent election just a few days ago, Vladimir Putin's party pretty much won everywhere, which was seen as an affirmation of him. People are saying they like his strong approach.
Well, the Yeltsin era, particularly the latter part of the Yeltsin era in the late 90s, democracy was equated with chaos and sleaze, and corruption was rampant, and more importantly, perhaps, public sector employees, whether it was the army or the police or teachers or doctors, they weren't being paid. So it was very easy for somebody like Putin to come in and, to use that time-honored phrase, restore order. But he's been far more clever than that, because he has, as I say, he's opened up just enough. It's like turning on a tap fully, but then you close it just enough in order to exert enough state control.
And at least officially, he and Medvedev have been pushing for more diversity in the political area. At the same time that they've done everything possible to prevent that.
In pure legislative terms, their parliament not so long ago passed a law on freedom of speech that is almost as perfect as you could possibly find. It is an exemplary law.
It says that there's total freedom of speech.
Yeah, and all newspapers and media should be able to operate unless they do particularly heinous, illegal things. It's absolutely fine. But, of course, 99.9% of it is never applied.
And when journalists are killed and there are suggestions that perhaps the government was behind it, another kind of message is sent.
Absolutely. I mean, I knew various journalists who have been killed there, Anna Politkovskaya and Natalia Estemirova, who was a human rights activist who was killed in Chechnya last summer, and her body was dumped in a nearby republic. What is so interesting, however, is the response of ordinary middle-class folk to these sorts of outrages. They would say, yes, it's terrible. They are reported in the newspapers. It's not as if they're not reported, but they're reported fairly coldly. They would say, yes, it's terrible. Yeah, Russia's still got a lot to do, but now let's go out to a restaurant. It doesn't permeate through because they are too busy, as I say, enjoying these private freedoms.
My guest is John Kampfner, who was the editor of the New Statesman magazine from 2005 to 2008. He has won a number of awards, including the Current Affairs Magazine Editor of the Year. And his book, the book we are discussing, is Freedom for Sale: Why the World is Trading Democracy for Security. It's published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after this. Later on in the show, we will look into efforts to stop a very destructive species of Asian carp from entering the Great Lakes. And in our next hour, it's Fun with Words and Grammar, when Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls and questions about our complicated and often confusing mother tongue. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with John Kampfner, K-A-M-P-F-N-E-R. His book, Freedom for Sale, Why the World is Trading Democracy for Security, is published by Basic Books. Couldn't it be argued that capitalism sometimes works better in places that aren't democracies? I'm thinking of China and Singapore, which are thriving.
Singapore is my model. Singapore I was born in and I was brought up, and I find it endlessly fascinating. I have a lot of Singapore Chinese friends who have had fantastic tertiary education, been at Harvard and Oxford and all these other places, and they travel all the time. And nevertheless, they're entirely comfortable with this trade-off. They're entirely comfortable that when they go home, they do not enter into the public realm. And they argue it not just from an assumption of lazy materialist consumption. They also say it is more cohesive. It helps the cohesion of society, particularly different ethnicities, and it just keeps society, as long as you have a good government and good governance and a lack of corruption, that's the end of the story. And what is so interesting is that Lee Kuan Yew, their longtime leader, and many academics that I dealt with, and I spent quite a lot of time at their national university there, they could come on this show and they could argue a brilliantly cogent thesis for why their system is thriving. And what is so interesting is that what the times I was at this university, Chinese regional leaders and politicians were pouring all over the Singapore example, which, if writ large, could be a model for the future.
Well, it's a post-colonial success story. You mentioned no corruption. I don't know if there's been any corruption, but unlike so many other former British colonies, Singapore has really thrived. And it has. People do remember the old days, don't they?
Yeah.
When the country, or whatever we
call it,
the
Malayan insurgency. There was all kinds of problems when the place started. So there is a genuine sense of, if it can work there. You see, there's one example, which is simply say it's a small city-state, that's the end of the story. But if, for example, the Chinese and the Russians and the Arab Emirates and various Middle Eastern states and some African states are looking at this idea, this shades of grey, this idea of elevating private freedoms over public freedoms, and it's something that could be the 21st century model for a semi-authoritarian state.
Well, it sounds to me like Big Brother in some cases, because people snitch on others for being antisocial.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a time Americans made a big thing about the fact that you couldn't have chewing gum.
Yeah, and your hair had to be above a certain length for men. Those sorts of street-level interfering laws have pretty much gone now.
But according to Amnesty International, Singapore also has the highest execution rate in the world relative to population.
That is absolutely correct. And you talk to people about that, they say, yeah, hey, that's the price we pay.
And corporal punishment, that's still caning.
That's the price we pay for a society. Meanwhile, let's go out on the tennis court.
Well, Singapore also has forced the resettlement of different ethnic groups into government-built apartments to create what you call enforced harmony. Now, all of this, I would think, would upset a lot of people.
Yeah, and it upsets me. And what was interesting, because I was denounced, it was absolutely fascinating what is going on, because I was denounced twice by the Singapore government in the pages of British newspapers for writing what I did. And the most pernicious aspect of Singapore society is their defamation culture.
Mm-hmm. They sue journalists for insulting them even when they reported the truth.
Absolutely. You can be sued for insulting, and then if you can't pay the sort of $10 million fine, they put you in prison for defaulting on your fine. So the main opposition, politicians, journalists, they're all in prison. This is what's so clever, not for what they said, but the fact they couldn't pay the fine. And that's the way they do it.
There are also, you say, no meaningful opinion polls.
Yeah.
So we have no real idea what people think.
The elections, which are the most bizarre occasion, the last one a couple of years ago, 30% of the population voted for ostensibly opposition candidates. Only two or three of which, if my memory serves me correctly, got into parliament because of the way they manipulate the election results and the constituencies and all that kind of thing. But again, you see, what is so interesting is that they go through the hoops. They have a legal system that is quasi-legitimate. They have a political system that has multi-party elections. as I say once again, what is so interesting is that this is not the model of autocracy that we dealt with and we were forced to confront during the Cold War, where it was just much more straightforward. And I don't get a sense that Western policymakers, either when it comes to assessing their own state of democracy or assessing how they deal with these countries, have a clue yet how to cope with the situation, because it is going to grow.
Well, it's also easy to deal with a country like Singapore, so it makes trade easy. But the real question winds up, what is real democracy? Is democracy what somebody defines it as, or is it what the people who are perfectly happy living in a country
see it as being? One of my chapters is Italy. If democracy is the will of the people, Italy has freely and fairly, not once, but three times, voted for Silvio Berlusconi, a man of extraordinary financial irregularities, a man who tries to close down any independent judiciary, who tries to buy up and then close down any independent TV or radio stations, leaving aside all his personal life sagas. And time and again, he is voted for. So if you are an advocate of the practice of democracy rather than any outcome-driven policy, then Italy is your place. I mean, it's as close to, in terms of political systems, it's as close to a failing state as you could possibly have.
And in this case, it's because the majority of Italian men seem to admire Berlusconi, see him as the ideal for themselves.
Well, we all define freedoms.
I know I'm going to get angry mail, but I just read that in the newspaper. A poll was taken.
Yeah. But we all define freedoms in different countries in different ways. I mean, here you have the First Amendment and their various particular American approaches to freedom. Somebody said to me that the primary Italian freedom is the freedom to avoid being caught. And whether that's being caught in your private life or whether that's being caught, more importantly, evading taxation, Berlusconi is your person. He is particularly adored by the small shopkeeper community. It's basically anybody with a small business, which is disproportionately high numbers in Italy. And he's your kind of person. You try to get him involved in issues such as probity and governance, and that's for the other parties that never get voted in.
My guest is John Kampfner. His book, Freedom for Sale: Why the World is Trading Democracy for Security, published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said that the Chinese pored over what was going on in Singapore when they were thinking of changing their economy. Is this during the Deng Xiaoping period?
No, I'm talking about now. They are looking at the way Singapore orders its society and the way it opens up to the West in terms of the material side of life, but closes down all other aspects. And how can you translate and expand an approach that is relevant to 4.5 million people in a small city-state onto a bigger realm? But they're doing it. Provincial leaders are looking at this. But it's happening in other countries as well.
But how have they been able to resist more democracy as there's been more economic prosperity? Because when people have money, then they want other rights.
Oh, well,
they?
You see, that bit, I just fundamentally disagree with you. I would like to have believed that was the case. That was the great Barrington Moore thesis.
Well,
no,
it worked
no bourgeoisie,
in the past.
No,
Japanese, it happened in Japan, it happened in France. To some degree, it happened in this country because ours was, to a large degree, a middle-class revolution.
It may be globalization since 1989 and the collapse of a political alternative has produced what I call the anesthetic for the brain. In other words, the aspiration, whether you're in Amman, Jordan, whether you're in Romania, whether you're in Luanda, Angola, the aspirations are very similar, and they are defined predominantly through material well-being.
So materialism trumps democracy?
Materialism trumps democracy time and again, as long as, and this is very important, the state provides the private space and the private freedoms for the individuals. If you don't do that, then that's when you get resistance. So, for example, in Russia, which has not developed yet according to this paradigm in the way it needs to.
And why is that? Is because there are just too many people with their hands on the pot?
Yeah, it's basically, it's the nexus between state security and politics. So, for example, if you're a businessman in a Russian province and you antagonize a local political figure in some way, probably by just not giving him a big enough kickback on a big enough bribe, then what they will simply do is close down your firm. They'll find some spurious mechanism, auditing or this or that, and they will close it down. And where you cannot provide these private freedoms, such as security of business contract or security of your own private property, if you think your house might be taken away by some arbitrary act of the state, then what you will do in the case of Russians is you take your money out of the country, you keep only what you need in the country, and you operate very much in shadow form. If, however, the sophisticated authoritarian state can provide you with all the panoplies that you need to survive and thrive in this more atomized existence, then that's fine. And your only debt to them, your only part of the deal with them, is just you won't cause trouble.
And that's what's happened in China, where we now have, I think, the second largest number of millionaires in the world. Yeah. You write that in Chinese intellectual circles, the phrase deliberative democracy is in fashion.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That is doing, a lot of it is around debating and discussing issues through the Communist Party, through networks, through sort of discrete discussions. Have these discussions behind closed doors, come to some sort of accommodation, and then implement that. What is the phrase? They hate this idea of humiliation and this idea of airing your dirty laundry in public. In other words, don't discuss criticism in public. Get your criticism in privately, and then as long as it's constructed in a way to improve society, then you'll get away with it.
Well, you also say that in one bookstore in China, you saw books by Milton Friedman and Chairman Mao right next to each other, which suggests that, I mean, just think of that juxtaposition in a Barnes & Noble store. Impossible. it suggests that they see something else happening there. Although Chairman Mao would have hated Milton Friedman, it was Deng Xiaoping who would have been more the admirer. How much is the legacy of the Cultural Revolution playing a role in all of this?
Well, I suppose similar to the way that there is a newfound affection for Stalin in Russia, and Putin trades on that. I think a lot of that I might be being a little bit naive here, but somewhat superficial nostalgia. It's just bring back the old days. But nobody really wishes to. But what they are looking for, or not they, because one cannot generalize, but what the critical mass, particularly of the middle class, is looking for, is this combination of order produced not necessarily by the Maoist time, certainly not during the Cultural Revolution, but maybe in Deng's time, and the ability to make money, which is the Milton Friedman side of it.
How does the world see the United States in this regard? Because during the Bush administration, we talked about democratizing, and then there were revelations of torture and an expansion of surveillance operations on Americans. We also encouraged democratic votes and wound up with Hamas winning an election in the Palestinian territories, much to our dismay.
The democratization agenda is so fraught with difficulties. I think Freedom House put it in 2000 or 2001 was the peak of the number of countries that could tick a box in terms of, yes, they've got multi-party democracy, yes, they've got enough free newspapers, whatever, hence they're a democracy. The issue that I'm more compelled by, I'm more intrigued by, is the quality of democracies. And democracies is not just about ticking boxes and getting the IMF in to sort out various issues of governance. It's about an active civil society, and it's about getting involved. And the two main problems with the democratization agenda, one was they didn't actually know what it would amount to. Is it a means to an end, or is it an end in itself? Do you wish to enshrine democracy, or do you simply want to give people the vote, in which case you'll get all series of unintended consequences, such as Hamas? And also, it's extraordinarily spurious to seek to export democracy when your own democracy is so flawed.
Well, this morning there was an NPR report that President Obama has yet to appoint members to a privacy and Civil Liberties Board that was set up under the Bush years, although all the members quit because they were outraged by censorship of their report, which was put together by both Republicans and Democrats. But here we have Barack Obama not signing on to something that he seemed to have promised, the expansion of civil liberties in the United States.
The civil liberties lobby is, as you know better than I do, is deeply despondent about the first year of the Obama era. I think there's also counterpoised to that is a feeling to give the guy a break, give the guy a chance, and maybe over time there will be an improvement. Certainly there isn't the pugnaciously hostile rhetoric of the Cheney ilk in the Obama administration. They make all the right noises. They made all the right noises about closing Guantanamo. They made all the right noises about the torture photographs. But as so often happens with center-left governments, they lack the courage to see it through.
And they're also under constant attack. For example, Liz Cheney, the former vice president's daughter, and William Crystal, attack lawyers representing detainees in Guantanamo who are now in the Justice Department. They're calling them the Al-Qaeda 7.
Yeah. Very interesting, after 9/11, I remember, and I cited in my book, Michael Kinsley writing in Slate, talking about the mush and gush that people are producing for fear of being seen to be unpatriotic. And he talked about, and he said he was doing it himself, and he said, I've been listening to my inner Ashcroft. And I think there is something in that for so many people here in America, but elsewhere, that sense of, particularly in times of difficulty, and you can always say you're at war. I mean, terrorism is here to stay. Asymmetric warfare is here to stay. So if you are perpetually at war, then you will always require perpetual measures to be on your guard. And the absolute fear that everybody in the Obama administration has is that he signs a law liberalizing one aspect of civil liberties, and the next day a terrorist attack takes place somewhere.
You mentioned the impact of globalization on all of this. Well, what impact do you think that the global economic crisis will have on these trends?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the crisis was really taking off as I was drawing to a close with my book. I had maybe another 3 or 6 months. And my immediate concern was to worry whether I should be writing this book in the present tense or the past tense. In other words, is this an ongoing phenomenon? Or was this era of conspicuous consumption and the pact, the trading away of public freedoms, a manifestation of a specific era, 1989 to 2008, 2009? I believed at the time that, maybe this was something specific and maybe something new would come out of the economic crisis. And I remember, whether it was Time or Newsweek a year or so ago, having a cover saying capitalism, RIP, question mark, and all this kind of thing. People beginning tentatively to look at the structures and the priorities of societies here and elsewhere. I have to say, pessimistically, a year on, nothing, pretty much, apart from maybe a little bit of regulation of the banks here and there. But both here in the States, in the UK, in Europe, elsewhere, pretty much nothing has happened. And the public have been very docile.
Well, ironically, part of one of the major reasons for this crisis was deregulation, which could be seen as a democratizing process.
That's a very American way of looking at it. I remember, the idea that my argument is that the state should have a role in economic regulation in terms of setting. Economic regulation is just the same as laws. It's just simply saying, these are the parameters in which to work. Now, having set
it's
these
like
parameters...
It's like don't rob a bank.
Yeah, exactly. And these bankers, many of them, you wonder exactly what they have.
Don't rob the local candy store.
Exactly. So, no, in my view, the regulation, sensible regulation, is what a good compact between state and individual should be. After that, the state should then leave you alone. What we've had... if I just reference the UK for a second, is what psychologists would call displacement theory. The state didn't do the work where it's supposed to do the work. In other words, looking after the individual against the potentially negative influences of the big economy. In other words, it didn't regulate where it should have regulated, and it spent all its time and its energy regulating individuals by spying on them. Did you know that in the UK, if your dog fouls the footpath or if you throw a piece of furniture illegally on the street, your local council can, without authorization, look at your emails and tap your phones in perpetuity because you have been deemed an antisocial individual.
Sounds like something that would happen in Singapore. John Kampfner's latest book, Freedom for Sale, Why the World is Trading Democracy for Security, is published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
John Kampfner will be speaking tonight at 7 at Book Culture at 536 West 112th Street. And tomorrow night at 6, he'll take part in a panel discussion at the Open Society Institute at 400 West 59th Street. For more information, you can visit our show page. Up next, Jennifer Nalbone, Director of Navigation and Invasive Species at Great Lakes United, explains why Asian carp are such a destructive invasive species and talks about the plans to prevent them from reaching the Great Lakes. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.